Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with 90-year-old Sal Dante of Las Vegas, Nevada. He grew up in northern Louisiana, spent many of his later years in Houston, Texas, and just recently moved to Vegas. Later on, we're going to hear about his most recent adventure with Honor Flight Southern Nevada. But for now, back to what this teenager was doing with the 638th Tank Destroyer Battalion in Europe in 1945.
So you have that close call where you're driving the Jeep, the shell hits behind you, it's a dud, so you go on and you sit that out until the strafing is over?
That was the second time.
Oh, what was the first?
I forgot to tell you the first time. Well, bivouacked after I joined the outfit between Belgium and Holland on the borderline there. We were taking we took a convent. That's where we all bivouacked in it. I went up on the second floor. A buddy of mine sat against the wall on the left-hand side. And I sat on the right-hand side. We just sat on the wall, leaned our back against the wall, spread our legs out, and nighttime Charlie came along, strafing that place. First shell came over his head and hit between his legs, next between my legs, next over my head. He was gone.
Wow.
Twice in a row, unlucky.
Yeah. And for folks who
scared the living devil out of me, I'll tell you that for sure. I shook like mad, but I got over it. Got in the Jeep and drove again.
I can see how that would get your attention.
Then we hit Market Garden. That was a big affair for the British in Holland.
Right, and I want to talk to you about that. And for folks who don't know what you're talking about, when you say Nighttime Charlie, that nickname, or some people call them Bed Check Charlie.
Yeah.
But the Germans would send planes over every night to bomb or strafe, and this guy was strafing this convent where you were and came, what, we're talking about inches away from hitting you?
Well, bam, a foot away from my crotch.
Between your knees.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
I was just sitting against the wall, my back against the wall, sitting against the wall. He was the same way, and the bullet came over his head and hit between his legs. Next one was between mine and over my head.
Wow.
We were very disappointed that it had to happen to be that way, because we have an outfit called the 557th. They had the spotlights for the catching the planes where they could hit them up high in the sky.
Right.
And they had a bivouac right beside our building. And when those damn searchlights drove the fire, we told them, get those dad guns away and move them away from us. We moved out the next day, though.
Uh-huh.
But that was a stupid thing to do, put us right next to the damn searchlights.
Yeah, nobody wants to be by the lights because those are
were
targets.
Drawing the fire.
Sure, sure. And I want to hear about Market Garden and your close calls there, but can you give us a sense of day-to-day, what a typical day would be like for you at this time? I mean, you're not even 19 years old yet. But you mentioned you had the responsibility of four guys.
Well, my first job when I got to the outfit, I just left Reams and joined them. And the first stop we had, they said, you've got to go to, with these two guys, grave registration, to pick up the remains of two boys that were hitting one of my tank destroyers. The major said, that's your job for today. I said, okay. Went with them. I got a pretty damn strong stomach. And they gathered our remains up in two little small poop sacks, little small flour sacks, put the remains in that. And brought them out. You want to see them? I said, yeah, I don't want to look at them. I got an iron stomach. So I looked at them and I said, oh, well, I have to know that you got their name tag so they can get it straightened out. And I gave them all the information they had for the information about what outfit we were in and everything. And then they took me back to the headquarters company of my battalion. And it was time for me to eat lunch right before I got back. So I had to come out and eat a K ration. I didn't want a C ration. I wanted a K ration. But it didn't spoil my appetite. I'm hard-nosed, I guess you might say. And my first experience in the war is having them recognize the remains and take them back for grave registration.
I was waiting for you to tell me that that iron stomach wasn't so iron in that situation, but you held it together, huh?
I held it together. We crossed the Atlantic Ocean. We got caught in one of the toughest storms you can catch. And everybody on the ship was seasick. It was, I told you, a luxury liner, a cruiser. It had 5,000 on a ship that carried 600 people. It had the bunks, five stack in every room.
Right.
The ones that grabbed the top bunk were the lucky ones. I didn't want anybody above me getting nauseated.
Yeah.
So I went for the top bunk. I got it and walked on the deck a lot of times because I never got seasick. I was very fortunate.
So you mentioned, you know, that first duty with the Graves Registration Unit. But on a day-to-day basis, what were some of the other things that you had to do that you were responsible for?
I had to type of reports of where we'd gone, what we'd done. And that was the main thing I had to do. Keep a record for the battalion to know what had transpired.
So in today, if we look up one of these after-action reports, those are the kinds of things you were typing.
That's right.
So, you know, for instance, January 24th, the division engaged the enemy here. This unit had these casualties. Maybe at some point this guy was awarded the Silver Star, the Bronze Star, the Purple Heart.
That'll be done afterwards.
Right.
After
but, that. But these are the kinds of things you did?
Yeah.
Got it. And some people might think, hey, that's a pretty safe job, but you're already giving us evidence that that wasn't necessarily the case.
In the war, nothing's safe.
Uh-huh.
When they're shooting at you, they're shooting at you.
Right. You mentioned something earlier about being a fatalist, that what was going to be was going to be. But were there times where you felt that fear or that thought that, you know, I may not wake up tomorrow?
Oh, yes. Lots of times I was scared to death. After we got straight that time of that shell hit and missed me,
yeah,
didn't go off, I couldn't even urinate. I was so scared. But I was shaking like a leaf.
Hard to blame you.
But I got over it pretty quickly.
You mentioned Market Garden. That was a big operation a few months before you got there that cost many Americans their lives. A daring attempt to secure areas around the Rhine River and potentially shorten the war. It did not have its desired effect, and those areas were still contested when you came through in the spring of 1945.
When we crossed the Rhine, they were shelling us like mad. We were with it. Attached to the Second Army as Montgomery's outfit. They crossed the Dadgum Rhine and stopped to have tea. We went on through them.
So the British get over these bridges.
I think it was their pontoon bridge that we went over. My outfit went over.
Uh-huh. But you get over the bridge, and here are the British, and they're just sitting there.
Yeah.
Because it was tea time.
They didn't mind being shelled. I thought they were crazy as hell.
Were there some more close calls for you there?
No. We heard they went through that whole area. Because they were clearing them out pretty fast, and they wanted to get across the Rhine, and they wanted to make sure that we had a way to get across the Rhine. So when they got that pontoon bridge set up, they went across and stayed there near the edge of the Rhine to protect it from anybody coming to try to take it over. So we went through them, kind of went behind the lines a little bit, I feel, but that's where we were. A tanker store battalion seemed to be the lead of everything else. Our tanker store was a T-3 tank with no top on it. It had an open turret with a machine gun, 50 caliber machine gun mounted on top of it, had a 76 millimeter cannon.
Right.
The Sherman tank had a 75 millimeter cannon on it, which wasn't as powerful for distances. We would go in a hurry because we could go 25 and 35 miles an hour, where a Sherman tank would be hard pressed to go better than 20.
Mm-hmm.
The Tiger tank couldn't go over 6 or 7 miles an hour. We'd go around behind it. That was the only vulnerable place they had on a Tiger tank was the back rear or right left hand corner. One of those two places. Everybody else was so thick the armor, even high-piercing, high-explosive shell couldn't penetrate it. It bounced off like mad.
And you saw a lot of these encounters between American tanks and German tanks?
Yes.
Because that's what your outfit was designed to do, take out the enemy tanks.
That's right.
Did you get used to that? Did that ever become old hat, or was it always?
No, nothing becomes old hat. You keep your wits about you all the time, but you never know what's going to happen. As I've told you from different experiences I've had, it can happen in a hurry, and you can just be lucky if you make it through it.
Had you become aware at any point throughout this, I mean, I'm sure you're aware that Nazi Germany is trying to take over the world. Had you become aware of what was happening to the Jewish people?
And I'm Jewish, and I attended the first Pesach service in Europe. We did it in Belgium for all the troops anywhere in that vicinity. 1st, 3rd, 9th Army, and British 2nd Army had several hundred of us, Jewish people, to attend that Seder service in Belgium.
When was that?
First Passover.
Yep.
And I don't remember, is it March?
Either March or early April,
yeah.
1945.
Uh-huh.
So being Jewish yourself,
I was more attentive to what was going on.
You knew what was happening.
I knew what was happening.
How did that make you feel about what you were doing and all these other guys with you were doing?
I was trying to do my best to save as many lives I could. That was my object, is to try to see how much we could do to get rid of the Germans and save as many lives we could to get them out of that place. We took over a concentration camp, my outfit, that 638 did, and they had already cleared everybody out. Instead of the 10-foot barbed wire fences there, that's unreal to have a fence 10 foot tall, but they wanted to catch them as they started climbing, they could shoot them. But they had gotten everybody out, and it was all gone, went to the camp. It was fairly cleaned up, surprisingly so. Ramshackle barracks, but we saw what it was going through. It was not too far from Hanover, because we took Hanover.
So, you know, I realize we're bouncing around here a little bit.
That's my fault.
No. But as folks hear you say that you are a Jewish American soldier in Europe, you've had these close calls with the enemy, Nazi Germany, which you're aware is persecuting, trying to exterminate the Jewish people. Did you ever consider the possibility that you might be captured and wonder what might happen to you if you were?
Yeah, I knew that if I got captured, I'd be in a hell of a mess. After I joined my outfit, we were driving in Germany. I was driving the Jeep, and the lieutenant said, let's go this way. And we went that way, and there was a dadgum MP said, no, you can't go this way. You got to go that way. I said, that's the wrong direction, sir. He said, follow the directions. I followed it. We ended up in a German town that hadn't even been captured yet. No soldiers left at all. The people were waving white sheets that were out of the windows and everything. I said, sir, we're in the wrong place. Let's get the hell out of here. I turned around and went back, and that MP was gone. He was a German officer, German soldier, dressed in MP uniform, directing us. That's what they did in the Battle of the Bulge. Sent you the wrong direction all the time. As soon as I saw I was out of jurisdiction of our men, I said, let's get the heck out of here. And I turned that Jeep around, and I came back, lickety-split, went back to the battalion, and planned our future skirmishes to the left and started to the right.
That's like straight out of a cartoon, you know, where you see the
yep.
the bad character flips the sign around to point the other way. But
they did that over there plenty of times.
These are Germans in American uniforms speaking perfect English.
Yes.
I know you were just a teenager, but to be aware that Hitler and his regime were trying to eliminate the Jewish people just because they were Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
How did that make you feel?
I wanted to see that so-and-so gotten rid of in a hurry.
Could you even grasp that someone would want to do that?
No. Hard for me to understand how that could do something to somebody like that. After the war, seeing those pictures made me realize that we were lucky that we didn't have to kill more of them. Oh, I had one experience I didn't tell you about.
All right.
It was in Germany. I was sent to the left side of my battalion headquarters company to be a spotter. And another man a couple of yards down from me on the perimeter of our bivouac area. All of a sudden, here comes this German officer towards me. I kept telling him, halt, stop, cease. I couldn't get him to stop. He turned around and started running. I had my carbine. I said, halt, stop, enough times. And he's about 60, 70 yards from me. And I cracked down one shot in the middle of his back and killed him.
Mm.
I went and took what I could off of him. He happened to have a pistol. He was using a Spanish Martin automatic. Instead of a German Luger. I was hoping to get a Luger off of him. But I got food. But I still have it here.
Still have the pistol.
Mm-hmm. I took it out shooting it but just before I left Houston.
Uh-huh.
A little over 6-7 months ago to the firing range here. I shot extra with a pistol and extra with a rifle. I bought a rifle from him and just tried it out. I did lose my technique, so I'm glad about that.
You must have been shooting possums growing up in Louisiana or something.
I was a young black boy with a .22 rifle. Single shot, bolt action. He would only shoot the eyes out of the squirrels, out of the trees. He was that good of a shot. He taught me how to shoot.
Uh-huh.
And back to the concentration camp. This is early April 1945. This was the Alam camp. In recent years, it's become the subject of a documentary called The Angel of Alam, which I have linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com. And it sounds like you're somewhat thankful that you got there after the prisoners had been evacuated.
I don't remember anything about the camp, quite frankly, except 10-foot-high barbed wire fences. I must have blotted it out of my mind. I knew exactly where it was. It was there, Hanover, Germany.
And
I tried to save some things out, but a few things I managed to save, I put in a little tin box, and I turned it into the Holocaust Museum here. I took all the medals off that German officer I'd killed and ribbons and everything he had on him. Put that in the box.
So you remember this barbed wire fence, and you were aware of what had happened there?
Yeah. For when overseas, we already knew what had happened. We had heard reports before that, because I had family that were killed in the Holocaust.
Cousins?
Our great aunt uh-huh. and all her children.
So as a Jewish American soldier, you come across the scene of where many Jews have been exterminated.
I think that they had satellite camps.
Yep.
And that's the one we took, was the first one we took, was a satellite camp. They already moved everybody out into the big camp. That's why I said we didn't see anybody except 10-foot-high barbed wire fences. It was a small camp. Probably had about 5 or 6 cabins for the prisoners.
Right.
My first taste of a concentration type of camp.
And looking back now, is there some satisfaction for you knowing that even though you had a lot of help, I mean, there's 16 million Americans in uniform during World War II, but that you had a hand in this?
I did my part as much as I could.
And even though there were millions of lives that couldn't be saved.
True.
What you guys did over there spared the lives of a lot of Jews who would have been killed. As bad a shape as they were in when they were liberated.
A lot of them were liberated, barely could walk, couldn't even talk. You know? So I'm looking at the pictures of the Holocaust over and over again. It's a reminder of what can be if the world goes to pot again.
Well, yeah, that's often the most powerful impact of examining our past, isn't it? That hopefully we are not doomed to repeat it, but can learn from it. And we're learning a lot from Sel Dante. Time for another break, but when we come back, what the end of the war was like for him and what he got out of his trip to Washington, D.C. with Honor Flight Southern Nevada. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.